The Recipes for Life podcast is a conversation about my favorite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. This podcast is presented by the Pete Evans Healthy Everyday range of super blends, including collagen super blends, bone broth super blends, and check out our new all grass-fed, grass-finished beef liver capsules. And there's more to come. You can find out more at gelatinaustralia.com. That's www.gelatinaustralia.com. Dr. Terry Walls is a clinical professor of medicine at the University of Iowa, where she conducts clinical trials. She is also a patient with secondary progressive multiple sclerosis, which confined her to a tilt-recline wheelchair for 4 years. Dr. Walls restored her health using a diet and lifestyle program she designed specifically for her brain and now pedals her bike to work each day. She's the author of The Walls Protocol, How I Beat Progressive MS Using Paleo Principles and Functional Medicine, and The Walls Protocol, a radical new way to treat all chronic autoimmune conditions using paleo principles, which is in paperback, and the cookbook, The Walls Protocol Cooking for Life. You can learn more about her work from her website, terrywalls.com. That's TerryWahls.com. She conducts clinical trials that test the effect of nutrition and lifestyle interventions to treat MS and other progressive health problems. She also teaches the public and medical community about the healing power of the paleo diet and therapeutic lifestyle changes that restore health and vitality to our citizens. She hosts a Walls Protocol seminar every August where anyone can learn how to implement the protocol with ease and success. Follow her on Facebook, Terry Walls MD, and on Twitter at Terry Walls. Learn more about her MS clinical trials by reaching out to her team, MS Diet Study at healthcareuiowa.edu. Dr. Terry Walls, it is such an honor to have you on our podcast, Recipes for Life. And we go back quite a few years, actually. It was a few years ago that we got to cook together a delicious meal of liver and onions with a side of greens. And also, there was a beautiful multicolored salad, which has become part of my cooking repertoire. So thank you for teaching me a delicious recipe, because it was your family's recipe, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We love cooked greens and we love liver and onions.
If only we could get the population to love liver as much as you and I do. That's the task at hand.
We just have to teach them how to cook it. You know, my children really enjoyed liver and onions, and we could have them and their teenage friends over and they would enjoy the liver and onions as well. So it's a matter of learning how delicious those foods really are.
And talking about delicious, what I want to explore with you and our listeners are going to love is your story and your remarkable story of who you are, what type of doctor you are, what you've discovered, what ailments you have, and how exactly you have got into the business and you are, where you're actually setting in motion, I guess, a chain reaction of events that is going to change the health landscape of where I see potentially the world. So let's put the magnifying glass onto Dr. Terry Walls and let's go back in history a little bit with your story, please, Terry.
So in 2000, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. At that time, I'm an associate professor of medicine at the University of Iowa. I believe in the newest drugs, latest technology. So I want to treat my disease aggressively with the best people in the country. I go to the Cleveland Clinic, which is one of the best MS centers in the United States, and take their newest drugs. But I continue to decline. And by 3 years, I'm in a tilt-recline wheelchair and I'm taking chemotherapy. I have been told about the paleo diet. I switched to that after being a vegetarian for 20 years, but I continue to decline. I've given up all grains, all legumes, all dairy. I start on Tysabri, the new biologic drug. I continue to decline. Then I switched to Cellcept, another disease-modifying drugs. I continue to decline. And I start taking some vitamins and supplements, thinking that mitochondria are the problem. And that improves my energy just a bit. I continued reading the latest science. I discovered the Institute for Functional Medicine. I have more vitamins and supplements. And then in the summer of 07, I have a new big idea, which is I should redesign my paleo diet to get the nutrients in the food that I was taking in pill and form. And so I restructure my diet, and I pay much more attention to meditation. And I've always been exercising, the small amount of exercise I could do as a person severely disabled with MS. But when I've redesigned my diet in a very specific way for my brain cells, my mitochondria, within 3 months, I'm walking with a cane. In 6 months, I'm walking without a cane. And in a year, I'm back on my bike for the first time in 6 years, and I'm able to do a 20-mile bike ride with my family.
And how did that feel?
Oh, my God. It really felt miraculous. Because with progressive MS, no one expects you to ever recover. Functions once lost are gone forever. And at that time, I stopped my disease-modifying drugs and continued to do well, continued to get steadily stronger. I changed how I practiced medicine. I changed the type of research that I do. And now my clinical focus is all on diet and lifestyle. And the research that I do tests the effect of diet and lifestyle in the setting of multiple sclerosis and other chronic health problems.
So tell us a little bit about the current tests or research that you're doing in Iowa.
Sure. So when I first recovered, we were able to do a little pilot study where I just tested exactly what I did and 20 other people with progressive MS. And we showed that it was safe, it was well tolerated, and we could reduce fatigue, improve motor function, improve quality of life. Then we did a few other pilot studies that were randomized with a control arm. Again, they were all had favorable results. We now have a study funded by the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, where we are, again, in a randomized fashion, comparing people to either the SWANK diet, which is a low saturated fat diet, to the modified paleo diet, which is basically the Wallace diet. And we're looking at impact on fatigue, quality of life, and motor function, walking ability, hand function. So we've got a year into the study, and we have 2 more years to go. We are very, very excited about the study and the amount of interest there is in the public for participating in this study.
So when this study comes out, it will be irrefutable or undeniable, the evidence?
You know, I guess we'll have to look at what the evidence shows us. We have a study design where we have an observation period for 12 weeks. Then we randomize people, 12 weeks of SWANK diet or 12 weeks of the Wallace diet. So we're comparing each diet to the observation period and then the diets one to another. That way, we'll know what is the benefit for each diet on fatigue and if one diet is better than the other.
And I guess you probably can't share too many of the details yet until the test is completed. Is that correct?
That is correct. We will, as results come in, analyze them and we'll submit them, preliminary data into the neurology meetings probably next year. But I expect it'll be 2019 before we have large enough numbers to really have any definitive statements.
Fantastic. I mean, I see a lot of research being done with a low-carb, healthy fat or paleo approach or autoimmune paleo happening now around the globe. And it's fascinating. And I can't wait for the next 10 years because it was only 10 years ago that you basically adopted this way of life. And how far has it progressed as far as mainstream goes compared to 10 years ago when you started this?
You know, when I first started, there really was reading about all this in 2002. This was some papers about the theory, no clinical trials. Then the first trials were small 2-week studies in healthy controls showing some changes in the biochemical markers. Then there were a few studies in the setting of diabetes, metabolic syndrome, fatty liver disease. I'm the first one to have studied it in an autoimmune condition. And we've got 4 papers out in this, looking at our studies, again, autoimmune condition. There's another paper that's recently out looking at this in the setting of psoriasis, and another paper that came out, small study, in the setting of inflammatory bowel disease. So there, in terms of studying for autoimmunity, that is just coming out. People are getting much more interested in dietary studies. And part of that is that as we've gotten better at understanding how diet turns genes on and off and how diet impacts the microbiome, so we understand the mechanisms by which diet has such a big impact on our health, there's more interest in funding dietary studies.
So where do you think the future of medicine is going? If you could look and forecast or predict 10, 20, 30, 40 years down the track, without it being a hope, I guess, where do you think it is going?
I am incredibly optimistic that we're going to have the public more and more interested in diet and lifestyle medicine, in part because of the social media that makes it easier to broadcast people's healing stories. And this just makes people more aware of the critical role of diet and lifestyle on their health. And then the basic science is understanding more clearly how diet and lifestyle has such profound impacts on health. So I think public demand will reward the health professionals who help them adapt and sustain diet and lifestyle, so these health behaviors, and that the public and the business sectors will decide that it's all about diet and lifestyle to improve worker productivity, economic productivity, lower healthcare costs, and improve quality of life. I don't think the governments can do this. I don't think healthcare finance companies can do this, but I think the public can do this. And I think more businesses will be very interested in supporting diet and lifestyle initiatives.
Let's just talk for a minute about the Walls Protocol, which is your amazing book that you released, which has a wealth of information in it for anyone that has autoimmune issues or basically anyone that wants to live a healthier life. Do you want to just take us through, I guess, the formula? Because you have a pretty simple formula, but a lot of people in this modern world would think it's quite different to how they're eating at the moment, even though I love it and it's how we eat on a day-to-day basis.
I love the paleo diet, but many of my paleo friends are, it's all about the meat and that's about all they eat is meat. My version of the paleo diet is it's all about the vegetables with some meat. And so I focus on making sure you have lots and lots of vegetables in the ratio of greens, sulfur-rich in the cabbage family, onion family, mushroom family is part of that sulfur-rich group. And then deeply pigmented like carrots, beets, berries. And the goal is to have 9 cups a day. And 3 cups would be the equivalent of a dinner plate that's been heaped up with your vegetables. So 3 plates of vegetables and 2 servings of meat that should be about the size of the palm of your hand. I'm very fond of organ meat, because they're such a powerhouse of nutrition, particularly liver and heart. I'm also very fond of fermented foods.
You're also fond of fats as well, because when we cooked together, we were cooking in duck fat and lard. So you're talking about 9 cups of vegetables per day. Now, that's uncooked.
Uncooked.
At the start, isn't it?
It's uncooked, so it'll shrink. It'll probably about half that amount once they're all cooked up. The advantage to having... I measure raw, and then as you cook them, they'll shrink. If they're greens, they're going to shrink even more. It's just simpler to start out measuring everything raw when you cook them.
And a beautiful way of doing it, obviously, is like the coleslaw that we did together or the matchstick salad, because if you grate a carrot, for instance, that's nearly a cup of vegetables anyway, and then you add a cup of beetroot grated to it, and then and a cabbage, you know, you could basically eat 9 cups of cabbage. It's pretty simple to do, and it's so cheap when you eat this way. And for instance, these days, I've been following, I guess, your protocol for the last 6 or 7 years as well, whereas I guess the formula for us at home is a big plate of vegetables with a side of meat or seafood and or eggs, for instance, cooked in good fats with some fermented foods. And it becomes pretty simple when you look at each plate of food or each meal that you have. And for me, I generally eat 2 meals a day, sometimes just one, but that's what the meals look like. So tell me about the benefits that you have seen or heard of from people that have adopted your protocol.
Well, for years, I ran a lifestyle clinic at the VA. And well, when I was seeing people at the VA, we had people who were living on food stamps, had been disabled. The biggest reasons they were coming to see me were severe pain, fatigue, and brain fog from a wide variety of problems, Pete. They might have an autoimmune issue. They might have depression, anxiety, chronic pain from an old war injury. And we would teach them how to eat green sulfur color and some meat and fish. I teach them how to do this on a budget. And we talk about growing their own food, going to farmers markets. And very quickly, pain would be decreasing, energy would be improving, mental clarity would be improving. The gentleman would come in. And we'd often have young people who had had war injuries, had severe pain. Many of these guys had erectile dysfunction. And their pain's getting better, energy's getting better, and their love life is better.
Fantastic.
Their irritability is less. It's easier to get along with their family. And what's remarkable, Pete, is that was across many, many different disease states. They might be coming in with rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or RA or chronic pain because it had an amputation and shrapnel due to war injuries. And for a while, my partners would be so upset I was using the same intervention for every disease state. They'd say, you can't do that. And I'd say, well, we all have mitochondria. We all have brain cells. We need to nourish our cells, and the body will repair if you give it the proper building blocks. And so now many of my colleagues who once were so skeptical are now like, you were so brilliant. You were so visionary.
Mm. I love that. And talking about growing vegetables, it's something that we've been doing now. Personally, I was a city boy. I never really understood any of this. And for the last couple of years, we've actually had our own veggie patch. And it's amazing how provided for we are once you have a vegetable patch and you plant certain foods like chard or kale or cucumbers or lettuces or fresh herbs. It's nearly like their whole goal is just to keep replenishing themselves and keep growing for you, and you can never keep up with it. And it's nearly a free source of greens that you can add to your meals each and every day. And I love your Instagram account, because on your Instagram, you're always in the garden and you're showing people where food comes from. How important has this part of your journey been to reconnect, or have you always had that connection to gardening and to nature?
You know, I grew up on a farm. And so I've always enjoyed growing things. When we first got here, we had flower garden, but we put in berries. I liked berries. We had a few fruit trees. And then we started throwing in greens in with our flowers, and we just keep adding and adding to our gardens. So it certainly has been enjoyable. We spent a lot more time growing our food. We've added hoop gardens, so we've extended our season this year. Mm-hmm. And it's fun. It's enjoyable. My kids say, you know, there's nothing like going out to your yard and picking your own kale or your own tomatoes and basil and having the food and just bringing it in and eating it right away. It tastes so exceptionally better.
You mentioned mitochondria before, and I'd love for you to be able to explain that to the listeners, just to give a definition of that and why it is so important that we actually look after our mitochondria.
Well, you know, about 1.5 billion years ago, the oxygen content of the atmosphere rose, and it became so high that it caused a lot of oxidation of biologic structures, and 95% of all life died. Because it was all single cellular organisms at that time. A mutation occurred that allowed for the development of what we now call the Krebs cycle, which let this bacteria use oxygen to more effectively run the chemistry of life. This ancient, ancient bacteria was engulfed by a bigger bacteria, and they developed a very happy cooperative relationship. And over the millions and millions of years, this would evolve into animals and would let the cells specialize. So we'd develop muscles and nerve tissue and bone tissue and blood vessels and a gut and a brain. And every cell then, in order to do its work, has to generate energy. And that little mitochondria, that little ancient bacteria, generates that energy more efficiently. So in some cells, like your brain or your heart or your retina, you'll have tens of thousands of mitochondria packed into that cell. And so for any of our organs to work really well, to do the job that's been assigned to that cell, to that organ, you have to have really efficient, effective mitochondria. And so if some of your organs aren't working well, the first thing you can do and the easiest thing you can do is help the mitochondria generate energy more efficiently. I had a bad brain. I knew that my mitochondria were struggling. And so that's how I first designed my diet and my vitamin regimen, was to support the efficiency and effectiveness of my mitochondria.
Fascinating. I love this. I have a question for you, because a lot of the people that I've interviewed were past vegetarians, and they all pretty much say the same story. They were vegetarian for a while or for a long period of time, and then their health issues kicked into place, and then they've discovered either paleo or low-carb healthy fat. Why do you think this is such a – I find it too much of a coincidence that there's so many in this field that were vegetarian who suffer bad health. I was one of them as well, and now have found this new way of eating, which is – well, not new, but it's nearly a plant-based diet with a side of meat or seafood.
Yeah. You know, I think there's probably some genetic variability that – there are people who, if you structure it properly, you can have a healthy vegetarian diet. But clearly how I structured my version with my genes was part of why I became so ill. I didn't have enough probably B vitamins. I probably had become mineral deficient. And I had probably an overgrowth of yeast in my bowels, all of which were made worse by my vegetarian diet. And on top of that, I was not, although I, as a vegetarian, actually liked vegetables and had a lot of them, I probably didn't have enough protein. I probably did not have enough omega-3s. I probably was not absorbing my minerals. And I certainly would have been deficient in my B vitamins, particularly B12. And that's a very common problem. Now, it is true that there are some, there's a recent study that said there is a higher rate of depressive symptoms in men who are vegetarian. And I think it was probably, I would predict it was likely tied into inadequate B12 levels for them.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because there's a few prominent Australian men that are vegetarians, and they also suffer depression, and they're very open about that. So it's interesting. So the recommendation would be to supplement with B12.
Yeah, you know, and I have several close friends and friends who are vegetarian, and I watch them, and what they've done is they've chosen to not eat meat for their particular belief system, but they are not eating vegetables. They're not attentive to make sure they have enough protein, and they're not taking care of their B12. And so I feel really bad, because they are setting themselves up for problems with anxiety and depression and perhaps brain fog issues. But they're all pre-contemplative, so I just have to watch, wait, and hope that they figure it out before they get into trouble.
That brings us to the next question that I want to ask you is, you yourself suffered ill health and have MS, which led you to design the Walls Protocol, or an adapted version of the paleo diet. So many people find this, I guess, this way of life, the paleo approach or an anti-inflammatory dietary approach, because they get to the end of their tether or they're in a position where they're very, very ill. Now, if I was a listener at the moment, and I'm listening to this, and I'm in pretty good health, I might be in my mid-30s, mid-40s, or mid-20s, or whatever it may be, and I eat a standard Australian or standard American diet, I exercise regularly, do you think these people should change their diet to eating this way? Do you think this is the perfect way of eating for everybody? How does this work? Because I meet so many people in my industry, and they come up to me and go, I'm healthy, Pete. Why would I ever want to give up my bread?
Well, probably if you want to have your best probability of having a clear brain, clear thinking, in your 80s, 90s, and 100, eating a low glycemic index diet, so lots of vegetables, healthy fat, sufficient meat, sufficient protein is the way to do that. Now, if you're a vegetarian for religious reasons or very important spiritual reasons, it is possible to do that as a vegetarian, but you have to do it in a very careful, structured way so that you can not get yourself into trouble. And the same thing, even with the ketogenic eaters, I really like a ketogenic diet, but the folks who do ketosis with 20 grams of carbs are creating problems with their microbiome. So I'd rather they do it with the medium chain triglycerides in my version of the ketogenic diet, which lets you have more carbs and is more nutrient dense. So we can all create diets that are a problem. Even the paleo folks who eat only meat and no vegetables can get themselves into trouble. So I think we have to be mindful. To me, you have to have plenty of vegetables. You have a healthy microbiome, high quality protein, avoid gluten. Those are probably the key things to keep in mind. I prefer that you have meat, but you can do it as a vegetarian very thoughtfully. If you're going to be ketogenic, you still have to do that very thoughtfully as well.
I love what you're saying there, because talking about ketogenic diet, I was talking to Dr. McCullough the other day, and he talks about cyclical ketogenic approach where you break out of ketosis maybe once a week or so, just so you don't stay in that realm for too long. And it's interesting because so many people are asking to measure carbs at this, and to stay at 20 or under carbs per day, I think, is taking it a little bit to extremes. I just like to fill the plate with beautiful food. And yeah. If ever I have to count something, I mean, obviously, if you have epilepsy or other issues, you may need to employ these.
You might need to do that.
For sure.
But, you know, the folks who follow me in the APOE4 community, these are folks who are at high risk of dementia, have taught me that they can go into ketosis using olive oil, still eating lots of vegetables, following my version of the diet, and just eat once a day. Yeah, they get themselves into ketosis that way. And I think that's a healthier way of doing that than doing the 20 grams of carbs. I think that is inviting risk of nutrient deficiency.
Yep.
And problems with your microbiome.
Yep. Well, you're not going to get your 9 cups of vegetables per day if you're going for under 20. Well, you might do it, but it'll be a pretty limited amount of or types of vegetables you're putting onto your plate. So going back to that question again, so many people say, well, my grandfather, he smoked, he ate bread every single day. He ate his cake, or my grandmother lived to be 95. Was there a difference in their gut microbiome than what we are experiencing today?
So our grandfathers, my grandparents, grew up during the Depression. They ate food out of their gardens, and there was the Liberty Garden. So they had many, many more vegetables than we had. They may have had bread or cakes as a rare treat. And the amount of carbs that they ate each day would probably been much more like 80 to 100 grams as opposed to the 250 grams that probably the average Australian or American is eating.
Mm-hmm.
And they may have smoked. They may have done alcohol. The problem is if you look around at our generation and our kids' generations, they're getting more obese, more diabetic. They have heart disease at earlier ages. If you want to be playing soccer with your grandchildren at age 80, playing Scrabble with them at age 90, reading and playing bridge at age 100, you should be able to do that. But to do that, you're going to have to eat a lot of vegetables, cut out the high glycemic index foods, and have liver on a regular basis.
You talk about brain health and dementia and Alzheimer's and other mental issues at the moment, or illnesses becoming so prevalent, it's nearly becoming an epidemic if it's not already. Same formula to prevent that? And is it reversible in any cases that you know of, or at least can you stop the progression?
Yeah. So a couple of observations there. My very good friend Dale Bredesen just wrote a great book, The End of Alzheimer's. He uses that functional medicine approach to treat dementia, and he has been able to stop the decline and help have people improve their memory, improve their function, even into early and moderate Alzheimer's.
Wow.
And I have observed the same thing as well. So absolutely, it can be. And I've met people with APOE4, two copies of the gene that put you at high risk for dementia. And they're in their 90s, following my protocol, doing great, playing chess. And it's just like, damn. You know, and they're the ones who taught me that they could get into ketosis using olive oil, eating 9 cups of vegetables, and eating once a day.
Wow.
So that's what I do now. It's like, hey, that's, you know, and eating once a day is certainly very easy.
So basically what you're saying is the formula is pretty simple. Follow this formula and it has the potential to prevent most modern day illnesses, if not being able to either better manage and sometimes even reverse symptoms or these illnesses. Is that correct?
Correct. You know, as a side effect of improving your health, you often find your blood pressure improves, your blood sugar improves, the amount of prescription medications that are required are steadily reduced, and that the number of prescription medications that you need is often steadily reduced. And the longer you stay with it, it's very common that you can eventually get to no prescription medications whatsoever. It's not quick. It will take time. But there's nothing like feeling better and better and better and better.
I agree with that one for sure. There is nothing as great as feeling healthy. And I guess that leads us to the next bit of advice that I'd love for you to be able to share with our listeners is your, I guess, tips outside of dietary advice. What are the ingredients that you embrace as part of your recipe for life these days, apart from diet?
Well, I'll tell you my typical morning. I'll get up, I'll do some stretching, and I will do some strength training. I will swim, and then I take a sauna, and then I take my dog for a walk, and then I go off to work. And now I can't get all that in every day before I go to work, but I do get all that in every day. I'd say my sauna is probably 5 out of 7 days, but all of the other stuff, stretching, strength training, swimming, walking outside, that's a daily occurrence. And by doing it in the morning, I will greatly improve my ability to sleep at night because I've done my exercise in the morning and I've gotten outside for the daylight, so my circadian rhythm is appropriate. And then I surround myself with people that support my health-promoting choices. And I minimize my exposure to people who sabotage my health-promoting choices.
That's a really truthful statement there. And I wonder how many people actually employ that, because when you want to change your diet or your approach, you're nearly changing your identity a little bit, which can, I guess, cause people to feel a little bit uncomfortable around that decision, because you might become a mirror for their own selves. Any advice for people that want to change but are worried about how certain members of their family, their friends, their work colleagues might view them?
So I would try to avoid a food event with people who are going to sabotage my food choices. So you might need to avoid food-related events initially. And then the other thing I would do is I would eat before going. So I'd never go to a food event hungry. And then I bring some food that I can eat, but I would have my meal ahead of time and then bring something that I could eat. But it's certainly a disaster to go to a food event that's going to have excluded foods in front of you hungry, because those foods will find their way into your mouth.
They'll find their way into your mouth. It's so true. Anyone that has never taken the plunge to change their eating habits as, I guess, as beautifully as what you're promoting here, what we promote with our own lifestyle, what are your best tips or best piece of advice for anyone that wants or that knows that this is the way to go, but they're petrified or they're scared or they're not sure whether they can do it? They think they might fail. Can you give some nuggets here of warmth and love?
You begin the journey, you make a mistake, you just start over. and realize that, yes, you do the best you can. And if you make a mistake, eat something that you wish you had not, forgive yourself and start over. I also encourage you to get everything out of the house, out of your environment, so that you're surrounding yourself with foods that are compatible with the new eating plan that you've made for yourself. So if you're going to go gluten-free, you take all of the foods that have gluten, put them in a big box, and you give them away to your friends or family or your enemies or the food bank or the compost, according to what feels best, most correct for you. And then you have your pantry and your refrigerator filled with foods that are compatible with your new eating plan.
Fantastic. So it's so simple, and it's something that everyone can adopt. And do you advise people to start with this slowly, or do you think all at once, or is it up to the individual what works for them and their family?
If you're in my clinical trials, once you see me, you're in the program, boom. If you're in my clinical practice, we get you started on the diet, and we recommend you go home and take all of the bad food out. And you can ramp up the vegetables gradually over time. If you do them all at once, you may find that you have some GI upset and you're going to have to adjust, because you may have some bloating or some loose stools, and you'll just have to adjust how many greens you can tolerate and are there particular food vegetables that disagree with you. So easing into it in general may be easier, but I would take the excluded foods out all at once.
And as far as drinking goes, what do you recommend? Is it filtered water, spring water?
Well, here in the United States, you have to, and I assume that this is probably true in Australia. I think we all need to be a little suspect as to what's in our water. Mm-hmm. In many cities, there's a drug residue in our water because of all the pharmaceuticals in people's urine. There are pesticide residues in private wells. So having a system that has a very effective charcoal filter or reverse osmosis, some sort of water treatment process to get your water as pure as possible, I think it's worthwhile. Reverse osmosis purifies the water, but it takes out a lot of minerals. And so there's a trade-off there. But it's certainly money well spent on getting your water as pure as possible.
Yeah, we have reverse osmosis in Sydney because it's connected to tap water or town water. And obviously there's fluoride, chlorine, the whole lot. So we have a reverse osmosis system there, and then we remineralize it through another system to put back the minerals basically and restructure it a little bit. But it is interesting, and I guess just touching on that, because I've been in the papers over here ridiculed by talking about fluoride and possibly that it should be a choice. If people want to put it into their water supply or their own glass of water for their family, then it should be a choice. But I don't think it should be a mandatory thing that we have no choice over, and to install a couple of $1,000 filters to try to get rid of it. Your thoughts on fluoride, if you're happy to share?
Well, you know, around the globe, there are various countries that spend a lot of money removing fluoride because of concerns about neurotoxicity and toxicity with bone toxicity. Then there are other societies, Australia and apparently the U.S., that add fluoride in an attempt to decrease cavities. And societies that have added fluoride now have an epidemic of fluorosis, that is fluoride staining of the teeth, so these little zebra stripes on kids' teeth, an abnormal coloring of the teeth. And if once you add fluoride to the water, the dosing of the amount of fluoride that people will get is highly variable because of you don't know how much water that individual is going to be consuming. So I prefer to not take fluoride. Now, you can make the fluoride less toxic by being sure you have enough iodine in your body.
And many parts of the world are relatively iodine deficient. And the problem there is that when we added iodine to our salt, and then medical society said, go salt free, reduce your salt intake. And so we reduced our iodine intake. And fluoride and bromide and chlorine are all halogens that compete with iodine. So because these things are added to our water and our food supply, the fluoride, chloride, and bromide, it increases our iodine requirement, but our iodine intake has declined, making us much more vulnerable to fluoride toxicity.
Wow. Maybe get a filter or use rainwater. Hey, Terry, it has been a joy to have you on the podcast, and I really appreciate your time today. And you are traveling around Australia and the world doing tours soon, and
yes.
I will let everyone know where they can see you. I just wanted to say we love you, and I can't wait to cook with you once again. And I look forward to you sharing with me one of your other family favorites.
Yeah.
And I'll make sure I post the recipe for the liver and onions.
Yes, yes. I'll be there in Australia in April and May, so hopefully I will see you soon.
Fantastic. Thank you, Terry. We love you, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Pete.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.